So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. I know we have some new people, the newer kind of people here. And older people. So please, before we return to Shu Yun and our empty cloud and teachings on the prerequisites for Zen practice, anybody have any questions about the practice? Anything that we did tonight, the sitting, the walking, mindfulness practice, the loving-kindness practice, anything that's not clear and that one doesn't know how to practice, not only on the cushion, but in their daily life? So is anything not clear? Good. Some of the people here are doing a good job. Thank you. So we are reading from, and again, I think we've been at it for a number of weeks. I just haven't gone too far, right? You'll help me. For those of you who haven't been here these last couple of months, maybe, what I'm trying to do is share with you the teachings from contemporary, he's no longer with us. His name is Shu Yun, S-H-S-U-Y-U-N, the kind of greatest Chan / Zen master in China of this century, and actually last century. He died in the 60s at the age of 120. You can imagine historically to live a life in China that began in the 1840s. Not only went through the last dynasties and emperors, but also the establishment of the republic, and then the establishment of the communist revolution. He also experienced the Red Guards, and he lived through the repression of Buddhism under that. So very interesting life, Shu Yun. And was an incredibly wonderful master in many ways. And this is something called a discourse, a method of practice in the Zen hall. Again, I said it before, but just we are familiar with the word Zen, right? But that's Japanese. And it's actually Japanese for the character that's in Chinese pronounced Chan. So you don't tell a Chinese Buddhist, "Oh, you practice Zen." They practice Chan. And then when they went to Japan, they called it Zen. So this is Chan Buddhism. And before he is getting into the essentials of Chan practice, Zen practice, he said there are four prerequisites. Now, this is so important, and I said this before every time I try to get this, and I say it again. The prerequisites, we want to get to the big stuff, many people. We want to get to the deep stuff. We want to get to the profound stuff. We want to get into the stuff that leads directly to awakening. We are high achievers in this culture, and, we're a little grandiose in our in the way we conceive of practice. Again, if you are building a house, right? I mean, as someone who lives in a house, we really don't care about the foundation, do we? I mean, that's not a thought about us. We care about how the rooms look, right? We care about how the outside of the first floor, the second floor look. Well, most of us don't think about, the quality of the foundation, do we? But the truth is, you cannot put your house just down on the ground, can you? Right? You have a lovely house, you just want to set it right on the earth. Is it going to be a disaster? Right? We all know that, right? In the same way, we need a foundation for our practice. If we don't have a foundation, we will not have a good practice. We will not have a consistent, stable practice. Which means, and when I say that, it means we won't have the kind of life that we're hoping through the practice of mindfulness, through the practice So whatever spiritual path we are following, whatever meditative path, transformative path we are following, we will not realize it, and it's often because we don't have a foundation. Right? Again, thinking about setting the house down on the ground, you know, there may be nothing wrong with the walls. There may be nothing wrong with the ceiling. There may be nothing wrong with the roof. You've done it right. But you have no foundation. And it will begin to lean. It'll begin to crack. It will be uneven. Over time, it will not be a comfortable place to live in. So foundation is essential. And the foundation, again, it's not like you lay the foundation, build the house, and then take away the foundation, right? That's another thing we like to do. Oh, I already did, you know, I already went through those prerequisites. So, you know, now I'm an advanced, highly developed practitioner. I don't need them anymore. No, we always need them. The house always needs the foundation. They are the bed. All right. Is that clear? I mean, I say it's clear because it's really got to be clear. There are many, many, many people who have good aspiration for healing and transformation and who practice sincerely, but they don't have a good foundation. And along the way, they develop cracks in their practice. And they wonder why. They think it's their problem. It's not. It's the foundation. And not enough work has gone into the foundation, and not enough continuous work has gone into maintaining the foundation. I don't want to belabor this construction metaphor. You know, the construction industry is in big problems in Florida, so I don't want to belabor it. But anyhow, we need to have a good foundation, and we need to take care of the foundation. Now, what is, and again, in different Buddhist traditions, these foundations are expressed differently, these preliminaries are seen differently. But this is what Xu Yun, who in his English translation, his name translates as empty cloud, very Zen name, empty cloud. So the four he said were, are, deep faith in the law of cause and effect, two, strict observance of the precepts, three, immovable faith, and four, choosing a Dharma door method of practice. Now, does anybody remember which ones I finished last time? I'm pretty sure I did one, right? I did the cause and effect. Did I do strict observance of the precepts? Does that ring a bell? Well, if it doesn't ring a bell, that means even if I did it, we can do it again, right? All right. So again, quite simply, one has to understand that this world, this life, our own body, mind, operate under the law of cause and effect. This is not a random universe, nor is this a universe controlled by forces outside oneself. This is a universe that proceeds because of causes and effect, whether that's in the world of science, whether that's in the world of physics, whether that's in the world of human history, sociology, psychology, right? Medicine, disease. Right? If there is an effect, which means something is happening, there is a cause. Right? And, you know, there are primary causes, secondary causes, tertiary causes, all kinds, you know what I mean? There's lots of variables involved. Now, this obviously relates to what's going on in the world, but as importantly for each of us in terms of what we're talking about here is that my mind, the thoughts that arise in my mind, my emotional life, the activities of my body, right, are all, as they are manifesting in the present, it is because of past causes. Right? Now we can, you know, everybody has different past causes they look at, depending on their spiritual, religious, psychological, etc. way of looking at things, but that is a given. Now, why is this so important for each of us? Because we are in the business of transformation. We are in the business of change, right? And if we understand that anything that is arising in my life right now, in terms of my life, my body, the thoughts, my emotions, it is all because of what's arisen in the past. I cannot control the past. I cannot control that it is arising right now. But I do have the power to what? How I deal with it. There's my freedom. I might have said this last time, I'll say it again. Practice begins, the saying in Buddhism, practice begins with the second thought. Right? Sounds a little strange, eh? Because, as you know, the first thought just comes to you, right? It just comes. The impulse to do something just comes, right? It is, why does it come? It's because of cause and conditions that are driving it. So something arises. A thought arises, a feeling arises, an emotion arises, an image arises, an impulse arises, a desire arises, a fear, right? Anything arises, right? That's first, right? You can't control that, right? You know that, right? It happens just like that. Practitioners, we begin to practice at the second thought, which means, what do I do now? If I don't do anything, I will continue. My life will continue to unfold the way it always has. Right? If I act reactively on that thought, that feeling, that emotion, it will just continue. I will not change. I will not transform. I will not heal. I will not wake up. So practice begins, you know, so don't feel bad if all your old stuff is arising. You know, a lot of people go, you know, well, I'm practicing Dharma now, I'm practicing meditation, I'm a new person, I'm a spiritual person. And then we're kind of humiliated, embarrassed, frustrated, angry, because all the same old stuff. There are better words to the garbage, you know, it continues to arise. And we think what? It shouldn't be like this, should it? Right? Because I'm a new person. And I think I'm a new person because I've read a book. Or I come to weekly meditation, or you know what I mean, or I cross my legs, you know. It's not. It doesn't work like that, does it? So even though we are outwardly making changes, inwardly our karma, which means the cause and effects, will continue to arise. Okay, they will continue to ripen in us. Right? Is that clear? This is so important. Okay. If you know, I just bought a new house in St. Pete. Well, as the warmth comes and the rains come, all kinds of things are growing. You know. Now, why? I don't want them to be growing, right? I can really, you know, be a victim and say, oh, but I didn't even plant them. This isn't fair, right? And yet, the truth is what? The seeds are in the ground. And when the causes and conditions are right, the water, the sun, the heat, they arise. In the same way within us, we have seeds in each of us. Seeds of happiness, seeds of sadness, seeds of goodness, seeds of badness. Right? Seeds of loving kindness, seeds of anger. And when causes and conditions are ripe, bingo. Now, your practice is to understand that that's all that is happening, right? You know, when all these little oak seedlings are taking over my garden, right? Should I be angry? Right? Should I be stomping around, cursing? Cursing my life, cursing buying the house, cursing the oak tree, right? For letting these acorns go. Right? Should I be cursing the sun for heating up the earth? Should I be cursing the rain? No. I have only one decision. What? What's my decision? Yeah. Do I let them grow, or do I cut them out? Right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's really sort of like that, isn't it? Or else I could say I could trim them up. I mean, there are variations, right? So we can add that, right? Do I just want to let them grow any way they want? Do I want to control them, you know, and kind of trim them up? Or do I want to dig them out? That is what we are dealing with every day, moment to moment, right? As our past karma ripens in our body, speech, and in our body and mind and thought, and in our life. Right? And each of us, depending on how aware we are, how mindful we are, and how strong is our mindfulness, have more or less a choice. Right? Do I want to continue to let these patterns continue to run rampant through my life, right? Blossoming and growing stronger and stronger? Right? Do I want to try to trim them a little bit? Some of us do, where we like to, you know. Do I not want more oak trees in my garden? I want to plant other things. Now, that's the other part of understanding the law of cause and effect, right? One is, I understand why things are ripening, and I understand how to deal with them. And two, I understand cause and effect. I understand that I can plant new seeds. Okay. And new seeds, if they are properly cared for, right, will also ripen in the future. This is the transformative path of Dharma. Right? And the Eightfold Path, this is called right energy. It is the energy of how we cultivate positive and negative seeds, how we transform our karma. I know how to deal with the ripening, that which is ripening in the past, and more importantly, I know how to plant seeds and how to cultivate them so they grow strong in the future. Which means I know through that process my future will be different. It cannot be otherwise. Why? You know, is this you know, some sort of mystical mumbo jumbo, right, that I'm talking? No, it is the law of karma. It is the law of cause and effect. I know that if I take care of the old seeds that are ripening, and if I plant the seeds that I want in my consciousness for the future, and I take good care of them, they will ripen. I will become that person. I will have that life that I want. But it's, you know, this is the rub. It doesn't, you know, it just doesn't happen like that. It is a process. So, I don't know, we can say more about it, but I do want to begin to move through this. So let's just leave it at that. The first prerequisite is that I understand karma, the law of cause and effect, which means for each of us, we reflect on it, you know. Reflecting on it means not just like we do now, where we reflect on do we understand it conceptually. But it means as your day is going on and things are arising, you are understanding, oh, this is arising in me because of that. It's another thing the Buddha said. This arises because of that. That arises because of this. It's kind of simple. Is that clear? So, which means in the midst of the arisings, we understand, oh, of course. Of course I'm feeling this. Of course I'm responding to this person like that. Right? Of course I'm reacting in this way. This is the way I always have. There's no mystery here. You know, so we're not thrown, we're not frustrated. We understand, oh, of course. Yeah, I understand my childhood. I understand the way I was raised. I understand all that. Look, you know, I understand why in this moment I cannot be different than I am. Right? But I also understand that if I have some space, some mindfulness, some awareness, I can begin to transform. Is that clear? This is key. It's transformation. Any questions? I mean, I just make sure it's, because there's a lot here and I'm being sort of quick. I mean, is everybody clear how profound, simple but profound for your own transformation? I mean, he puts it first. So he's saying, please make sure you understand it, not only so you can, you know, so we can have nice discussions about it, but so you can live your life based on this principle. You understand how it works. And you understand also how it works with everybody else, right? So we're no longer befuddled, confused, disappointed, angry at everybody else in the world. Because what? Because they're not acting the way we think they should act. And the only reason we could think that is because we're not understanding that they have their karma too. That is controlling them and running them, causing them to react in that way. And unless they begin their own process of transformation, other things begin to happen with them, they will continue to act the way they act. So we're not, you know, there's an acceptance. It's an acceptance that comes from understanding. Not an acceptance that comes from resignation or defeat or, right? It comes from deep understanding of this law of karma, cause and effect. It's going to be quick.
When I do a lot of mindfulness meditation and I have a person that I love, a person that I say, how does the cause of the law of cause and effect?
Well, again, if you think about, you're basically doing two things. You are especially, again, for the person that you are again. One of the things we're dealing with in the meditation on loving kindness, again, because we are attempting to unconstrict the heart. The heart has been constricted by the ego. By the self, right? So, it likes this one, doesn't like that one, and then it likes the one it didn't like, and doesn't like the one it used to like, and, right? Hates the one it used to love, and loves the one it used to hate, and couldn't care less about anybody else, until they treat them nicely, and then you go, oh, what a nice person that is. So most of our way of relating is egocentric. So we want to change that. And we do that through the practice of loving kindness. Because what we're doing, again, as opposed to this constricted way of functioning with our heart, which is, love like a few, dislike hate a few, and not care about mostly everybody. We want to have the capacity to offer friendship to everyone. That is changing, clearly, our karma. Because we're making now new causes. We're no longer, strongly liking, strongly hating indifference. So it's a very transformative practice. It also has a capacity of, if Catherine is my dear friend, right? Catherine can act like a complete idiot, And I'll be understanding because she's she's my friend, right? But if Catherine did the same exact thing and she's on my dislike list, it'll be just more reason for me to dislike her, right? I mean, that's how we operate. We're really foolish. I'm being nice here. You see what I'm saying? And when we understand that, and we offer friendship to everyone, it's been this way of disliking it, when Terry does it, Terry does the same thing that Catherine does, but, I like and dislike her, accept and don't say, because at this point I like Catherine and don't like Terry, or vice versa. So I want to get rid of that and be able to offer understanding and friendship to everyone. you know, I will be as understanding with Catherine as I am with Terry, because I see them both as friends. So I'm no longer dividing up this world the way we divide it up. And we know the world is has a great capacity to divide itself up, right? I mean, we make enemies, you know. Huh? I mean, it's just sort of like natural to have enemy lists that just grow and grow in this world. Anyhow, number two. So the first is of the four prerequisites is deep faith in the law of cause and effect. The second is strict observance of the precepts. This actually relates to one. Okay, so this is what, again, in the Buddhist path. Just a moment ago, we talked about right energy, of how to deal with these positive and negative seeds. This has to do with what's called right action. Okay, it is an understanding that goes back to the time of the Buddha that, again, it is in the actions of our body, it is in the actions of our speech, and in the actions of our thoughts that we are kind of driving our karma, that we're creating causes which will have effect, right? And this really has to do a lot with the world of relationship. So the Buddha set forth certain kind of basic kind of moral principles, guidelines, right? Just to try to say, you know, if you want to stop creating a lot of suffering in your life, stop doing this and start doing this, you know? So, these precepts, Thich Nhat Hanh calls them training, some things that we are training in, these need to be a definite part of our life. Right? So the first, for example, the first of the five is do not kill, and protect all life. Do no harm. Because we know when what? When we do violence to another human being, to other human beings, when we do violence to the earth, when we are not protective of other human beings and the earth, negative things will happen, negative reactions will happen. I mean, I think this is a group I don't need to explain that to. So, you know, it's really one of the first steps of civilization was to end, you kill me, I'll kill you. Right? That used to be kind of the way the world operated. And you can see, it is endless. Right? I kill you, you kill me. I kill you, you kill me. I kill your brother, you know what I mean? I kill you. You know what I mean? Societal, it wars, personal. I mean, it creates such suffering, violence. On the other hand, to offer protection to sentient beings, right? I am here to protect you from suffering, from harm. I'm here to protect you from illness. I'm here to protect you from starvation. You know what I mean? It is such a different cause to make in this life. Another one has to do with not taking what is not one's own. It's kind of an obvious one. If we all go around grabbing anything we can grab, right? It will produce in the person we've grabbed from what? Hurt, anger. Again, you can see these are sort of societal, personal boundary issues, we take from the earth things that really aren't ours to take, and we pay for it now. Yeah? So it has not taking what is not given, and respecting things as they are, not exploiting. It has. I'm not giving a talk on the precepts, so I'm just kind of going through them. One of them has to deal with sexuality. Obviously, the misuse of sexuality, to see another human being as someone to exploit simply for your own needs, can lead to lots of suffering. for himself and for others. We have to honor the sacredness of bodies and of other people's feelings and their capacity to love. So we have to be mindful around the issues of sexuality. The big one has to do with intoxicants. Long before the recovery movement, long before the addiction field was developed, the Buddha said, be careful. And that's interesting. A lot of that has to do with both for individuals. I mean, it's obviously when one has a clear mind, one is able to see cause and effect, or see the effect of one's actions. But if one is intoxicated, if one is high, one can act in all kinds of ways, right? So very interesting that the Buddha early on said, you know, avoid the use of intoxicants, keep the mind clear at all times. But also, obviously, for meditators, drugs, alcohol, and mindfulness meditation, sort of a bad mix, you know, they really... So, and the fifth of these has to do with speech. Again, a real awareness that the primary way we relate to one another is through words, and words have the capacity to be supportive, to be constructive, to be compassionate, to bring clarity, right? Or words can do harm, words can be cruel, words can confuse, words can cover over, right? So developing a real awareness of one's capacity to speak honestly and sincerely and compassionately and et cetera, is again very important. You put these five together and what do you have? Love or a good life. You know, you have a good life. Yeah. Right. Right. But in terms of relationship, it means you have the basis for a good life. If you think about society, if everybody, whatever their religion was or non-religion was, if everyone just followed these five basic precepts, what a different world it would be. As simple, I mean, this is so simple, right? And yet, we people don't observe these things. And because they don't observe these things, we put out all kinds of negative causes into ourselves, into our relations, our families, our societies, the world. And we end up with the world that we ended up with. So, again, he's also saying, you know, if you want to change your karma, these are five easy ways to do it. I mean, I'm kind of simplifying, but it's almost like that. It's really saying, you know, just stop doing this and do your best to do this. And you will see almost instantaneously changes, shifts in your life and in your relationship with others. Right? And everybody here knows that, right? Everybody here who ever had a problem with alcohol and drugs know when they eliminate it or certainly tone down their use, things change for the better, right? It's simple, right? When one stops using harsh speech, angry speech, cruel speech, disrespectful speech, and when started talking to people in a kind, supportive, loving, constructive way, relationships change. Right? We all know that. So, please, again, please reflect on this. Thich Nhat Hanh is a wonderful book. It's called For a Future to Be Possible. It is a exposition of these five trainings and or precepts and how they operate both in the personal life. But it's interesting, he called his book on the five precepts of training For a Future to Be Possible. And he was talking about the world. He wasn't just talking individually. He was saying for a future to be possible for the world. For our children, for the next generations, right? observation of some kind of standards of conduct, some kind of basic moral humanistic principles that we can all agree on is a necessity. Right? Whatever our religious or non-religious, spiritual, social, political views, right? How wonderful that would be. Now the third is immovable faith. It's kind of a word that we usually don't associate with Zen or Chan, because this is not kind of a faith-based religion, Buddhism, and so we're not used to hearing that word faith. And actually, I think it's probably a wrong translation, to be honest with you. Translation. Again, because this is whoever did this translation translated from the Chinese. Yeah, yeah. So it's more, usually in Buddhism the word is trust or have confidence in, right? So he's saying here one must have immovable confidence or trust. So then the issue becomes in what? Right? And I would say what he probably means here are a couple of kind of unshakable, immovable things that anybody practicing the way of Zen or Chan or anybody who wants to practice this path with some level of sincerity. One has to believe that one has a true nature, a Buddha nature. This is a discovery of the Buddha. Okay? In his great enlightenment under the Bodhi tree over 2,500 years ago, in his very personal existential transformative experience in his meditation, he was blown away by a realization within his own mind, that deeper than thoughts, deeper than conditioning, deeper than emotions, deeper than the conscious and unconscious and subconscious mind, that there is a ground of mind, which means the ground of all our minds, that is unstainable, that is pure, undefiled, that is beyond birth and death, has no beginning, no end, and has this incredible capacity for wisdom and intelligence. And that this is our true mind. It is not something we have to manufacture. It's not something we have to work on. It is something we just need to experience. Because for most of us, we live in a more narrow, constricted view of reality and who and what we are, which is more egocentric. This is not our experience, so we have to kind of have a confidence or a faith or a trust in this truth, right? Because it is marking the direction of our practice, right? Right? It is no different than if you lived in the middle of the desert and you had no water, and you ran into somebody who said, "I know where there's water." Right? And it's not in a part of the desert that you know, but it's a part of the desert that I know. And I've been there and I've drunk these waters. And if you want, I can tell you how to go there, or I can guide you how to go, you know, etc., right? So you have to trust that person, don't you? You have to have confidence that they're telling you the truth, because you're going to have to make that journey to that place of pure water. So this is one of the things in this tradition that one has to trust, have confidence. I think another thing that sort of goes along with it, and in a certain way I think in a funny way, well, let me just say, first, this one is hard. First, because most of us identify ourselves as screwed up. Right? Most of us identify ourselves with the garbage of our mind. Right? And we think that's who we are. And we look around the world and we see what a mess it is and the way most people operate, and we think, you know, this is the mind of human beings. Right? And the Buddha says, no. There is something much deeper, more profound. People are just operating at the surface. It's like, you know, it's like if you've never scuba dived, you think, you know, it's just the water is as deep as you can hold your breath or look. Right? If you never scuba dive, you think it's what, maybe 10, 15, 8, 5, 3 feet down. You know, and if someone was a scuba dive, get a couple on your feet, you have to take it on faith, right? And they tell you, no, no, this is just the surface. This is just the surface of the ocean, right? I mean, what, you know, that whole BP thing, what was it, a mile down? How many, I mean, it's like unbelievable, right? A mile down. And it's even deeper, right? I mean, it's like, I mean, it's, I mean, we take it on faith that they're not just telling us a story, right? Because we have no experience of being a mile underwater. It's like that. We just know the surface. So the Buddha and the teachers and the masters tell us, no, there is something much deeper, and it is your own mind. You don't have to go anywhere. It is already here. The second thing is we have to have a movable faith and confidence that I can make this journey. This is a hard one. Many of us, again, we... for whatever reason, we have strong doubt about our capacities. Again, we kind of identify ourselves as screwed up, neurotic, broken, dirty, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Lacking this, lacking that. But we see ourselves as so highly imperfect. So this is another important piece. Not only do we have to have confidence and trust in our true nature, but we have to have trust and confidence that we can make the journey. And again, if you don't have either of these two, you need to reflect. You need to think about, reflect on, contemplate. You need to read the life of the Buddha, where he describes his enlightenment, his experience of his own true nature. You can read the lives of the teachers and masters of Dharma from 2,500 years ago until the present, and about their own experiences of awakening to their true nature. So you have confidence that it's not just a story, right? But that it is true and real and accessible. And you have to develop confidence in your own capacity to transform yourself. If you don't really believe that you can change your life, change the way you are acting, change the way you're feeling, change the way you're thinking, change the way you're relating. I'm not saying overnight, you know, but you see the trajectory, then the path is very difficult. Right? You can easily get frustrated. You can easily get disheartened. You can easily get distracted. So many people waste so many time. They just don't walk. You know, the third thing I'll say, you know, confidence, trust. You have to have confidence, trust in the path. Okay? Now, I'm not just saying the Buddhist path. That's my path. That's the path I know from experience and the path I teach. But there are many paths. But whatever path you take, you have to have confidence in it. Right? or else you will, you'll just, you know, you'll start, you'll stop, you'll go, you'll stop, you'll meander off, you know, and you'll never get to where you want to go because you don't trust the path. You don't trust, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of this analogy of the path. It's sort of like, all right, now I believe that there is this source of pure water, right? I'm in the desert. I believe there's a source of pure water, right? Okay. And I believe the guy who told me about it is telling the truth, right? And I believe it is possible to get there. And I believe I can do it. Right? Now he's giving me a map. Am I going to follow the map? We don't follow the map. I remember my first teacher said to me, he said, you know, if you start the Dharma book, he said, read it through to the end. He said, don't go reading the introduction from this book, first chapter from this book, second chapter in that book, third chapter in that book, fourth chapter, you know, that's not going to work for you. You know, first, you know, what he's saying is, you know, reflect on the path. Make sure it makes sense to you, that it's sound, that you're aware that other people have trod it, and it has gotten, it's gotten them to where you want to get. And once you've made up the your mind, that it is a reliable, it is pragmatic, it is practical, it is doable, etc., 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 then what? You've got to walk it, you know? And again, you can see, I mean, I've been involved with Dharma and spiritual paths for 40 years, and I see people who've wandered all over the place, you know, dealing with the same stuff 20 years later. And not that they're not good people, not that they haven't read all the books and heard all the teachings. It's what is it? They don't stay with it. They don't work it. They don't work there, you know, as I say in the recovery movement, you got to work your program, right? You don't work your program, it's not going to work. This is kind of a program. Again, and I'm not saying everybody's got to practice it to become a full Buddha and achieve full enlightenment. I mean, wide diversity of people here with wide diversity of aspirations. But you got to know what your aspiration is. It's got to be clear to you. Right? And then when it's clear to you, you got to make sure that you have everything else in place, right? Prerequisite. you get the word? You know, it's like, right? You want to climb my nephew and his significant other up climbing Mount Kilimanjaro right as we speak. Now hopefully they have a good map. Hopefully they have a good guide. Hopefully they're in good shape. And hopefully they'll stay on the path. Right? If that all is together, there's a good chance they will get to the top. Okay. You know, but if they forgot their mat, if they forgot their boots, if they just kind of, you know, meander about, you know, not only may they never get to where they want to go, but they may just get themselves in trouble. At a certain point, you might get sick of getting yourself in trouble. You may get sick of exploring dead ends, right? Especially when there are paths that are just very clear and direct and accessible. So we'll leave the last one for next time. But I think we've done pretty good. We've gotten three nailed down well. Keep faith in the law of cause and effect, strict observance of the precepts, and immovable confidence, trust. Before we end, are there any questions? I mean, I say that in the spirit of, you know, we just have to be real, authentic, and we have to... You know, the wonderful thing about the Buddhist path for me is always, the Buddha said, question what I said, don't take it on faith, and if they're blind faith, question, make sure it makes sense to you. Right? Yeah? And if it makes sense to you, if it accords with your logic and your rationality and everything, only then practice. So he said to his followers, he said, don't follow my path because of me. Follow it because of it makes sense to you. So that's important for all of us, that we, wherever we are in our life, we make sure this, you know, we do this foundation work. Make sure it makes sense to us. We trust it, right? Not blindly, we trust it because it's right, you know. And again, you know, I didn't talk about it, but the other, you know, one of the things is teachers. In Buddhism, right back to the time of the Buddha was a teacher. He trained teachers. Those teachers went out and trained more teachers, and so the Buddhist path has continued up to now. Right? So we have to trust our guide. Right? Hopefully, my nephew has a good guide, and hopefully he's trusting him. You know, because if you've ever been in a situation with a guide and you don't trust your guide, you're going to go, this is the one, this guy doesn't know any more than I do. You know? I wonder if this guy really knows the way. But these are things you should have answered before you set out. You know what I mean? You don't want to get out there in the boat, you know, and far from shore, and you realize this guy doesn't know how to sail any better than I do, right? So there are teachings in Buddhism about, you know, how to trust your, you know, not how to trust your teacher, but how to make sure your teacher is really an authentic teacher, and et cetera, et cetera. Again, because you want to get all this taken care of, you know, early on, right? So you're not plagued by questions and doubts and hesitations halfway through. Is that clear? So that's again why these foundation prerequisites are so essential. Don't be in a hurry. You know, we're in a hurry. Anybody ever live in a house that had a poorly poured foundation? Not good. Right? Foundation is most important. So please reflect on this, think on this in terms of your own life, whatever path you're following. Don't be in a hurry. Good. So again, thank you all for coming. I just want to say, I think most of you know, many of you know, that one of the things we do in our community for our community mindfulness, we do these intensive period of practices. We now have one starting the week called Developing Happiness and Solidity in One's Daily Life. We're using Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Happiness, as kind of the manual for the 12-week practice. We have about 60 people involved in this intensive practice with very specific kind of commitments. And I know that many of you are not in need, but I certainly encourage everyone over these 12 weeks, even if you're not officially in it, to, if you can, get Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Happiness and kind of work along with us at your own pace, in your own way. It's an interesting book. It's kind of taken maybe 30, 40 of the kind of practices that have been developed by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Phuong Village tradition, over the last 20, 30 years in terms of mindfulness practice, family practice, relationship practice, society practice, emotional practice, healing practice, and kind of put them all in one book. So it's a very nice companion, and I encourage everyone to practice along with us over these next 12 weeks. Again, information about the Florida Community Mindfulness, of which the Naples Group Sangha here is part of, you can find by going to our website, which is floridamindfulness.org. And again, I don't know how everyone got here tonight, but if you want to be on the email list, either for the only for the Naples Sangha or for the larger community, Florida Community for Mindfulness, you can, you know, sign up there. Any other?
We sent out an email to those who are taking part in the intensive that we would meet here on the 29th at 5 o'clock for the rest of Sunday City. And it says maybe there's a difficulty with space. So we'll assume it's okay. If it's not, I will email anybody.
You can
send
it on the website, and if you already recorded, and if you can listen to the
any other announcement next week? You guys are tough.
Yeah.
What? I know you have a schedule.
Next week we'll have the chanting ceremony, which we didn't do last week.
What did you do last week?
Last week we talked about thought.
Good.
Nice conversation.
Yeah.
Discussion about thought and what that means.
You know, Tana from Gainesville is doing this weekly newsletter with the announcements. And so if any, you know, can write up like just a little paragraph. I mean, not sort of a summary, but just kind of somebody just saying what struck them, can be more personal, what they found most interesting. Yeah. Yeah, just short little things, so that way different people in different parts of Florida or other things can kind of get...
Bill Volmer.
What?
Bill Volmer is going to be the...
Oh, yeah?
Email...
He's going to write something? But just tell him, he doesn't have to write, some people are starting to write summaries, that's kind of dry, just kind of, you know, just kind of what struck them. A couple of sentences, just kind of what they found most interesting, or this is kind of where the conversation went, or... You know, something like that.
And I'll say also about the chanting service next week. It's a chanting service, but it's also a recitation of the five mindfulness trainings, which are the precepts that Thich Nhat Hanh is kind of revising for modern times. So, after hearing tonight about the precepts and the prerequisites to good practice, wonderful to recite them once a month as a community. So I would encourage everyone to please come.
Anything else?
Donna Basket.
Donna Basket. And what is the Donna Basket?
Donna is a
And there's tea?
There's tea and cookies, so please stick around. There's a lot of faces. Say hello. Have some tea cookies.
And I'll see you all in 2 weeks. Thank you.